For many of us, seeing the beauty in other people, being kind and compassionate towards other people, that comes pretty easily. But what's really hard is seeing the beauty in ourselves and being kind and compassionate consistently towards ourselves, especially when difficult things happen. Perhaps someone's critical of us, or we make a mistake. We beat up on ourselves. You could call it the inner critic, or that voice in the head that says mean things. Or you could call it self-hatred. What can we do in these circumstances to interrupt this cycle and learn to befriend ourselves consistently? Sounds True has created the Self-Acceptance Project to investigate this question. We've invited the participation of spiritual teachers, psychologists, neuroscientists, visionary writers, all to look at how can we learn to be kind and compassionate towards ourselves on a consistent basis. Thank you for joining us and welcome. In this episode, I speak with Brené Brown. Brené is a research professor at the University of Houston's Graduate School of Social Work, who has spent the past 10 years studying vulnerability, courage, authenticity, and shame. With Sounds True, she has released the audio series, The Power of Vulnerability, and has an online course of the same name. Welcome to the Self-Acceptance Project. My name is Tammy Simon, and I'll be your host. And in our episode today, our guest is Brené Brown. Brené, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Wonderful, thank you.
I'm glad to be with you.
Now, I know this topic of self-acceptance, there's a lot of different words we could use, self-compassion, being kind towards ourselves, that this is a topic that you've delved into quite deeply in your work and your research. And here at the beginning, I'd love to know, what do you see are the roots of this challenge for people, the roots of being able to treat ourselves kindly?
I think at the very bottom of it, at the foundation of the struggle, is the issue of worthiness. I think that's the fundamental question. Do we believe that we are worthy of love and belonging? Do we believe in our own worthiness? And do we engage with the world from a place of worthiness? I mean, I think, you know, I kind of feel like the past 12 years of research has been this kind of slow unfolding, kind of getting deeper and deeper and deeper into what are the big blocks, what are the big barriers, and what is that small kind of tender, precious thing at the bottom that is really what is wounded and really is what needs to be held and needs to, you know, to be treated compassionately and kind of reborn in us. And I think that thing is our sense of worthiness.
Now I can imagine someone listening who says, okay, part of me feels worthy of being alive, worthy of love, worthy of goodness, and part of me doesn't. I don't really understand that part of me that does and doesn't, but I feel divided.
Right. And I think it's fair to say that most of us feel divided. And I think there are moments within, I was going to say there are, you know, there are hours within a day, but there are moments within an hour where I feel, you know, I personally really feel like in touch with my worthiness and I get who I am and I like who I am. And then there can be moments within that same hour that, you know, I really struggle with, God, I'm just, what's wrong with me, you know? So I do think we're all divided. I don't think it's, you know, it might be help to back into a little bit of kind of what I have found in my work. So the first, you know, 6 years of my work was really all about studying shame, connection, empathy. And one of the things I learned in those 6 years that I think was I think maybe for you, for Sounds True, for Season Sounds True listeners, might kind of be like, oh yeah, no kidding. But for the majority of people I talk to, it's kind of shocking. And it's simply that love and belonging are irreducible needs of men, women, and children. And in the absence of love, in the absence of belonging, there is always suffering. And so if you took the people I've interviewed over the last 12 years and you kind of crudely divide them into two groups, people who had a deep sense of love and belonging and people who struggled for it. And I think it's worth seeing at this point when I say people who had a deep sense of love and belonging, I don't just mean people who had the capacity to love, but people who believed that they were deeply lovable. The only difference that separated these two groups of people who had this sense and people who really struggled for it constantly was the sense of worthiness. The people who had a strong sense of love and belonging simply believed that they were worthy of love and belonging. And that for me was really shocking. And it wasn't just shocking, it kind of pissed me off because I didn't exactly understand what that meant. So when we went back into the data trying to operationalize, you know, worthiness, what does that mean? Like, is there a single moment where we say, oh, I get it, I'm worthy, and then, you know, it's done, like a checklist item. But when we went back in and looked, the people who had that sense of worthiness didn't have fewer divorces, bankruptcies, histories of trauma, addiction. They simply made different choices than the majority of us make most of the time. I kind of operationalized the belief in our worthiness into what I call guideposts. They're a way of making choices. It's about, the easiest example I can give you is these were folks who, even though it's culturally, it's counterculture really, these are people who chose things like rest and play over exhaustion as a status symbol or productivity as self-worth. These were people who chose to make sure they were doing something creative in their lives, even though comparison was always kind of nipping at their heels.
So, Brené, this sense, though, that most of us have to some degree or another, at least part of us feels unworthy. In your research, were you able to identify what the roots of those feelings of unworthiness are? I mean, is it have to do with our early upbringing? Are there mostly cultural factors? What was your sense when you laid out the map of why do so many of us, at least in part, feel unworthy of love and belonging?
Well, I think it's shame. And I think that the answer to your question, is it family of origin? Is it culture? I think the answer is yes and yes. I mean, I think shame, you know, I talk about shame as the gremlin. Shame, those messages and expectations that fuel thinking that we're not enough, we're not good enough. You know, you can fill it in, not pretty enough, rich enough, thin enough, popular enough, loved enough, promoted enough, safe enough, certain enough, you know, whatever it is, that we're not enough. And I think that the majority of those, I think a strong base of those messages are really set in childhood. I think that sometimes they're very clear. We could have, you know, we clearly have parents who say, you know, achieve this, you know, acquire this, your lovability is on the line. But in more cases than not, I think it's very subtle. I mean, one of the examples I give from my own life is illness. Like, I wasn't sure why, but I knew as an adult that whenever I was sick, especially if I had to miss work, I would be just riddled with shame. I would be like, oh my God, what's wrong with me? I'm weak. Why aren't I tougher? And you know, as I started to do this own part, my personal work, I thought, God, did my parents, you know, did they shame us when we were sick? Did they make fun of sick people? Did they, you know, and the answer was no. It was much more insidious than that. My parents never allowed themselves to rest or heal when they were sick. And so there was a very, while quiet, very strong message in my upbringing, you know, very German, very Texan, that being sick is shaming. And so I think at the core, a lot of these messages get set in our families of origin. I think culture absolutely contributes it. It's funny because one of the questions I get, especially from Jungian folks, they always want to know, do you think you can experience shame? Do you think you can have a shame wound in an area that wasn't a family of origin wound? And I think the answer is absolutely. I think parents can do, you know, can be very mindful about things like body image and all of those issues surrounding appearance, but keeping our children out of the media influence of, you know, thin, perfect, beautiful, is impossible. So I think it's both culture and I think it's family of origin messages.
So Brené, in your experience interviewing so many different people, did you find that every single person has some degree of shame in their experience?
Absolutely. I mean, I think shame is the most universal primitive affect or emotion that we experience. I think we have probably going on 40 years of really good data from other, you know, from quantitative researchers, from qualitative researchers that really show that the only people who don't experience shame are people who have no capacity for empathy or connection. You know, shame, you know, we're hardwired neurobiologically for connection. We're meant to experience love. Belonging is in our DNA. And so I think it's a helpful way to think about shame is the fear of disconnection, the fear of being unworthy of love and belonging. And so as long as love and belonging and connection are, you know, mandatory experiences in our lives, the fear of the disconnection and unworthiness will always be there. So we all have shame, and I think we have it to different degrees. And I think as important, or maybe more importantly, is I think we all have the capacity to develop shame resilience, to be able to move through shame and not only maintain our sense of worthiness, but grow more compassionate and connected as a result of our experiences.
Okay, so I want to talk about shame resilience in just a moment. But first, I just want to clarify one thing, because I think this is really important. So you think it's a mythos if somebody says, I want to live a shame-free life where I just never experience shame. That's my goal. I'm going to go for that. You would say that's just unrealistic.
Yeah, I don't think it's realistic. I mean, I don't think as a researcher, we don't see any evidence of that. In fact, if you look at Tangney and Deering's research or some of the other research where they evaluate shame, you know, I think shame is a part of the human experience. And unless you're talking about serious sociopathology, I think we all have it because we all are, you know, we all want connection. And so the fear of disconnection is real. So I don't think the goal is shame. I don't think the goal is shame resistance. I think it's shame resilience. I think it's I can experience it, but I can move through it in a way where I maintain my authenticity and I develop more compassion, connection, and courage as a result of the experience.
Okay, so let's move into this term that I think you've introduced into our vocabulary, shame resilience. At least I've never heard it from anyone else. Was that a term that you created?
I did, because I was looking for something that was, you know, you can't be shame-proof or shame-free, so I think resilient is the best way. I mean, to me, the definition of resilient is bounce back. You got some bounce in you, you know, and so I think that's what we're looking for.
Okay, so the first thing is, how do I know when what I'm feeling is shame? I mean, I just want to make sure we're all tracking right with you, that it's not something else that might be confused with shame.
Well, it's a really important question because the affect or the experience that we confuse the most with shame is guilt. And so it's really helpful to get, you know, to really tease those out and have an understanding. So shame is I am bad. Guilt is I did something bad. Shame is a focus on self. Guilt is a focus on behavior. And so the example that I use every time I talk or lecture is you go out on a Thursday night, you drink way too much, you're hungover Friday, you get to work, you're late, you miss a meeting. Is your self-talk, the way you talk to yourself, are you more likely to say, God, I'm an idiot, I'm so stupid, what's wrong with me? That's shame, focus on self. Guilt would be, God, that was a really dumb thing to do. Why did I do that? Focus on the behavior. There's a very, very significant difference between shame and guilt. We see that shame is highly, highly correlated with addiction, depression, eating disorders, violence, suicide. We see that guilt is inversely correlated with those outcomes, meaning guilt is a very positive, adaptive experience. Guilt is when we hold something we've done up against our values and who we want to be, and it's uncomfortable. It's cognitive dissonance. There's psychological discomfort. And so when we see people make meaningful change, when we see people make meaningful amends to other people, guilt is that motivator, not shame. Shame is so paralyzing and so painful that more than likely, if we're in shame, it's much more likely to drive destructive behaviors, drive rationalizing. If I hurt someone and I'm ashamed about it, I'm much more likely to say, you know what, because I'm in so much pain, you know what, screw that. Mm-hmm. She was a total ass to me yesterday. And if I hurt her feelings, you know what, that's just tough. Mm-hmm. Shame's a very different construct than guilt. So what we're talking about here is, and I would say part of shame resilience, to be honest with you, at least in my experience and doing my own work and interviewing folks, is part of shame resilience is trying to figure out the stuff that's driving shame. Is it realistic, unrealistic expectations? And how do I move from, and if it's just those, we need to let go of those expectations, and that's tons of work. But is it something that I want to move more toward guilt, that I want to say, you know what? I mean, I'll give you an example. I had a really horrific teaching experience several years ago. A really bad hurricane hit Houston, and we had a brand new president who wasn't from Houston and didn't really understand, university president who didn't really understand hurricanes and what those meant. And so the hurricane hit on Sunday, and she called class back in session on Monday. And 65% of the university students were displaced. And it was super stressful. I had no electricity for 2 weeks. Both my kids were sick. I couldn't get out of my driveway because live wires. I got to class late, and I just was a nightmare teacher. I made really bad decisions, and my stress just played out in the classroom, which is really hard for me to accept looking back, because that's a sacred space for me. Well, the whole semester was not, it was bad. And so when I got my teaching evaluations about a month after school ended, some people were so pissed off that they actually brought in typed qualitative evaluations of me and how I was hostile and shaming in a class on shame resilience, and they couldn't believe it. And I remember reading them and just, this is after I did a lot of work on shame and guilt, and I remember thinking, my first response was shame. Like, I felt small. I felt found out. I felt like something was wrong with me. And my immediate response was, you know what? Screw them. This was a terrible semester. They were acting like big babies, and then I was like, what are you doing? You made really bad choices, and you need to own it, and you need to go to guilt. You need to say, this is about the semester. This is not about who I am. And when I made that switch over to guilt and thought, I'm a good teacher, I'm a good person, and I made some really bad choices in the classroom, I didn't have the need to blame them at all. What I did have the need to do was to make amends and to contact every single one of them, apologize, and really think about how I needed to handle that differently next time. And so there's a very big difference between shame and guilt. Mm-hmm.
Well, as you're talking, I'm definitely getting the feeling for what shame is. As something that I feel afraid that other people are going to reject me. I mean, as you're talking, I'm thinking of body image issues, and I'm going to be cast out of the group because there's something wrong with me. That
totally.
Kind of feeling. And it feels unbelievably terrible. Okay. Brené, help me become resilient when this feeling overwhelms me.
Okay, so here's the really Yeah, you know, there's a lot of great news, I think, from my research. The first thing is that shame is universal. That thing that I explained that you're like, oh God, I get it. That warm wash that comes over us that we all know, it's completely universal and it stays powerful because it counts on us believing we're the only ones. And I'm here to say unequivocally that it is absolutely universal. So what I found, the other great news, I think, from the research is that men and women with high levels of resilience to shame, meaning they can experience it, they know what's going on, and they move through it constructively, and they really hold on to their self-acceptance and self-worth during the process. They had four things in common across all of the interviews, 12 years, men and women. And here's what they were. Number one, men and women with high levels of resilience, shame resilience, recognize shame, and they know what triggered it. What's interesting about that is that for the vast majority of us, the best way to recognize shame is its physiology. Shame really happens. I call it the full contact emotion. It really happens in the body. So one of the things I ask people to think about is when you're in shame, you know, here's the hard part. Okay, so right here, and I'm kind of like, this is crude. I know you're going to be talking to neurobiologists in this.
It's okay. I like the bottom line. Just give it to
me.
Yeah,
here's the bottom line. So yeah, prefrontal cortex up front, rationalizing, thinking, organizing. Limbic system, wired for one thing, survival only. One thing you've got to know about shame is because we're wired for connection. When we experience shame, we're mostly hijacked by the limbic system. It's not like when I'm in shame, I say, oh, I'm experiencing a warm wash of inadequacy and I'm feeling small and less than and not good enough. You know, we're likely to scream at our kids, yell at our employees, you know, talk to ourselves in ways we'd never talk to other people. And so the way you recognize you're in shame often is by your physiology. So I know that when I'm in shame, when something shaming happens to me, time slows down, I get tunnel vision, my mouth gets dry, my armpits tingle. It's the exact same responses that if I were driving on the freeway and an 18-wheeler in front of me jackknifed, it would be exactly the same responses. It's a trauma response because we experience shame as trauma, you know, and so one of the things that men and women with high levels of resilience do is they recognize when they're in shame and they get away from other people. Because when we're in shame, we really need some time to get back on our emotional feet before we start problem solving this. You know, we really need to, like, I know if something shaming happens or something shaming happens to me, it's going to take me 15 minutes before I'm fit for human consumption again. Like, I've walked out of a faculty meeting, I've walked out of my dean's office, I've walked away from my children. I know. And my mantra is don't talk, text, or type anything. So the first really element, I call them elements of shame resilience, is you got to recognize when you're in shame. You got to say, oh, God, I know what this is. Oh, my God, this hurts. And you have to figure out what triggered it. And that's, you know, that's super important. The second element is to practice critical awareness. So when we get back on our emotional feet, critical awareness is basically reality checking the messages and expectations that fuel shame. So let me just use a story, for example. I get an email from a guy who said, can you come speak at an event? I email back and say, thank you so much for the invitation. I can't. I've got a family commitment that week. He emails me back and said, you're selfish, you're not wholehearted at all, and, you know, you're a fraud. I mean, it was a completely mean-spirited, unwarranted email. So I forward the email to my husband with a paragraph just going off, like every cuss word you can imagine, horrible, you know, and I hit reply instead of forward. In that moment, I go into a deep shame spiral. Like my body is just, it's like, oh my God, I'm sending this guy this email where I'm just ranting about him. So the first thing I have to do is just, I close the computer, I walk away, I'm pacing through my house, I start crying, I'm like, what's wrong with me? Why did this happen? You know, and I really start to think about it. I get really quiet, I pray, which is a big thing for me. And what I realized is he is in my good girl shame crap. of please everybody, don't disappoint anybody. And so I'm like, okay, the next thing, what do I do? And this is the really counterintuitive part of shame resilience. You've got to reach out and tell your story. Shame thrives on silence. I've got to pick up the phone and call someone I love and who loves me and said, oh my God, I'm in a shame shitstorm. Here's what's happening. So I pick up the phone, I call my husband, and then I call my really good friend, Karen. I talk it through. They help me reality check that. They're like, you know what, Brene, we've all done that. You're not alone. If you use email, you're going to make these mistakes. You just need to know that we love you and we've done it before. And you're, again, you're, you know, the big words that cure shame, empathy, you know, is the antidote to shame. You're not alone. You got to reach out. And then the last piece is, you know, I needed to make amends. So I sent an email and said, I apologize. That was super inappropriate. You know, it was very inappropriate. It was not meant for you. But even if it wasn't meant for you, it was not the right thing to do. And then I set some very clear boundaries about how any communications between us could move forward. And that's how I got through it. And on the other side of it, it deepened my connection with my husband, Steve, and my friend, Karen. And it made me more aware of myself and also much more compassionate because lo and behold, about a week later, I get copied on an email from an event planner that was not supposed to come to me about me. Mm-hmm. And so shame resilience is really ultimately about recognizing that we're in shame, understanding the triggers, reaching out, telling our story, and ultimately finding a way to talk to ourselves in the midst of shame in the same way that we would talk to someone we really love. And that's the hard part of self-acceptance, I think. If I were standing behind my daughter, you know, and she did that, I wouldn't look at her and say, God, you're such an idiot. You're so stupid. What were you thinking? But we're all very quick to talk to ourselves that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting when you describe this reaching out part and how silence is the way that shame stays active in us, because you talked about shame being related to this fear that we won't belong and that we won't be accepted by others. And then we call somebody and lo and behold, our friends say, you know, I love you and I get it. And this happens to all of us.
Right. It's like, you know, if you have a Petri dish, remember the Petri dishes from high school?
Yeah.
If you put shame in a Petri dish, it needs three things to grow exponentially. Secrecy, silence, and judgment. If you put the same amount of shame in a Petri dish and you douse it with empathy, you create an environment that's hostile to shame. Shame cannot survive empathy. Mm-hmm. But oh my God, does it feed on silence, which is why shame loves people like me, perfectionists, because shame knows it can keep us quiet. Because, you know, when I'm in my perfectionistic set, you know, to me, you know, if you're doing a series on self-acceptance, I think sometimes in my life, the opposite of self-acceptance or self-love or worthiness is perfectionism. You know, and one of the reasons, you know, shame is the birthplace of perfectionism. And so for those of us who have convinced ourselves, and I like to think of myself as a recovering perfectionist, but for those of us who at some point in our lives convinced ourselves that if we looked perfect, lived perfect, and did everything perfectly, we could avoid shame and blame and criticism for us, when we experience shame, the last thing we're going to do, just as you pointed out, is reach out.
Now this is a powerful statement. Shame is the birthplace of perfectionism. Do you mean our perfectionism is a way that we're trying to avoid feeling shame because we just can't touch into it? It's too terrible for us?
Absolutely. You know, shame is, you know, one of the greatest things that I learned from this research is that perfectionism has nothing to do with striving for excellence. It has nothing to do with health, what researchers would call healthy striving. And in fact, when I speak, you know, when I interview really transformative CEOs, I mean, people much like yourself, or elite athletes, or, you know, people who have who have really feel like they have some wholehearted success in their areas. Not once did I have a person in 12 years say, oh, I attribute my success to the fact that I'm perfectionistic. What they all said was, perfectionism is one of the most dangerous things for me. I have to keep an eye on it all the time.
Mm-hmm. So it does seem like part of this whole process is I have to be willing to feel and acknowledge shame when it comes on the scene. I can't just try to run away from it and avoid it and cover it over. And I mean, I have to be willing to start right there.
Yeah, and because so one of the things I talk about is, after I did my research, I'm a grounded theory researcher, so I come up with theories based on people's lived experiences, and then I look at the literature, the academic literature. And so one of the things that I found in the academic literature that really fit squarely with what I had heard from people's lived experiences was from the Stone Center at Wellesley, where they talk about strategies of disconnection, which really goes to your point, the way you framed it, that shame is so painful that we've developed, knowingly or unknowingly, strategies to disconnect from the experience. We move away, we move toward, and we move against. So some of us move away, meaning in the face of shame, we just hide. We hide from it, we hide from the experience, we hide from the emotion. We secret keep, we stay silent. Some of us move toward, meaning in the face of shame, we people please. And we don't feel it. We just start figuring, you know, who can we suck up to? Who can we make happy around us? And then there's some of us who, in the face of shame, we disconnect from the pain by using shame to fight shame, which I've got a little bit of that in me. And most of us have all three of them, and we use them in different scenarios. If someone has more power than me, I have a tendency to people please. If it's a group that I really want to belong to, I have a tendency to disappear. And unfortunately, a lot of us have a tendency to use shame and rage with the people we love the most.
Yeah, I'm not 100% clear on this last one, using shame to avoid shame. Okay. I'm a little confused by that.
Okay, so let me give you an example. This is actually in The Power of Vulnerability, the CD sessions that I did for Sounds True, which was so much fun. I actually told the story because I think it's a great example. And I'll just tell a little bit of the story. I'm in an altercation. Someone says something to me very critical of me working and asking my mom and my husband to watch the kids while I did a business trip for 5 days. And it was a business trip that I felt really torn about doing because I had a 6-month-old at the time. And she was giving me kind of a very passive-aggressive hard time. She made a comment like, it must be hard to let other people raise your children for you. And, you know, it's my mom and my, right, exactly. Which, so some people, and I've done this before, would move away. They would just basically disappear. They wouldn't show up at school anymore. They would avoid her. They'd avoid their community, and they would really risk isolation. Other people would people please. They would look up at her and say, oh God, you're right. I should, you know, you're such an awesome mom. How do you do it? Which, you know, is not in my purview. But then what I really wanted to do in that moment was to look at her and say, have you seen your kids in school? You should try letting someone raise them for a week. Like, what I wanted to do was to come back with something as shaming and as mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, when you study vulnerability for a living, it's dangerous because you're good at doing that because you know what would hurt people, you know? Yeah. And I don't think you have to study. That's why we have a tendency to use shame with the people we know the best, because we know what we could say. That's like one of the worst characteristics that we see in shame-bound couples. Mm-hmm. And two partners, you know, one of the things that one of the kind of hallmarks of shame-bound couples is their fighting tends to get very mean-spirited, and they seem to they attack around vulnerabilities. And that's the kind of stuff that, man, you can apologize and you can heal, but that stuff leaves scars, you know. So when you say, you know, when you asked me, so is part of shame resilience having to lean into the discomfort and the pain of that feeling to walk through it? The answer is yes. as opposed to moving away, moving against, or moving toward.
Now, Brené, there's actually so much I'd like to talk with you about, but I'm only going to ask you two more questions. So here's the first one.
Okay.
You talked about, as part of the shame resilience process, treating oneself differently, saying different things to yourself as you move through these four steps, having a different attitude towards yourself. You could say one of self-acceptance. What have you found really helps start habituating new ways of talking to ourselves when we're feeling shame?
I would say, unfortunately, everything that I've learned in my research that is transformative is a practice. I didn't want it to be, I wanted it to be like a checklist item, but they're practices. And so I think we practice talking to ourselves differently. And I don't even know, for me, sometimes it's hard for me to get my head and heart around an attitudinal change, but I can talk to myself differently. I can say, you know what, you know, one of the rules we have in our house is no name calling, and that applies to self as well. So my kids can't call each other stupid, nor can they say, God, I'm so stupid, when they're working on their homework. And so if they mumble that or say that, then what I'll say to them, or what I'll ask them to say to me, if it's me doing it, is, you're struggling, what's another way to say that? Well, I'm not smart. No, I'm in over my head, I don't get this homework. Okay, fair enough. Then let's figure out how, you know, let's turn on Khan Academy, or let's figure out what we can do to learn what's going on here. So I think it's shame and guilt. The difference at the heart of it is about worthiness, but the practice of it is self-talk. How do you talk to yourself? And I think if we set an intention to only speak to ourselves like we would speak to someone we love, which is an intention I try to set every day, it is just practice. And it's so awkward. Like, I remember the first time I was doing it, I was thinking, it's okay, Brené, I love you. Oh my God, this is so ridiculous. Yeah. I love you, and you know what? You're human and you can make mistakes. I'm like, oh my God, this is the corniest thing I've ever done. But now, when I screw something up, which is fairly often, it's kind of my go-to place. Like, how would I talk to Ellen or Charlie?
Yeah.
Which is hard.
It seems like you've learned a lot from parenting about self-acceptance.
I have. I've learned a lot from parenting, and I've learned a lot from the research participants. I really thought that I would find that the people who had the stronger senses of worthiness had lives that panned out more beautifully than the rest of ours. They were people who, you know, didn't get stretch marks, or whose nail polish didn't chip, or, you know, didn't go through family interventions, or didn't go through hard struggles. But it wasn't that way at all. They just weren't willing in those times of really deep struggle to put their worthiness on the table.
Mm-hmm.
But they held on to that.
Brené, just one last question, which is, I'd love for you to comment on this sentence from one of your books, which is, loving and accepting ourselves is an act of courage.
For me, again, one of the things that was transformative for me is really studying the word. I study words a lot because it's part of my research. And the word courage is a heart word. It's from the Latin word cur, meaning heart. And the original definition of courage when it came into the English language was to tell your story with all your heart. And I think we only have two choices in our lives, that we walk into our story and we own our story, the good parts and the bad parts, the hard parts and the easy parts, and we own our story, and we love ourselves in the process of owning our story, or we spend our lives on the outside of our story, hustling for our worthiness. And I just don't think the hustle is worth it. I think we surround ourselves by people who love us not despite our imperfections and our vulnerabilities, but because of them. and we own our stories. And I think that's the bravest thing we'll ever do.
I've been speaking with Brené Brown as part of the Self-Acceptance Project, a series of conversations that we're hosting here at Sounds True. Brené, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks so much, Tammy. I enjoyed it.
Brené is the author of two new audio learning programs with Sounds True, Men, Women, and Worthiness, and The Power of Vulnerability, a series that is available both as an audio learning series and an online course. SoundsTrue.com. Thank you for listening. Many voices, one journey.